CliffCentral.com. Download the Cliff Central app, available now on the Apple App Store and Google Play Store.
Stay informed and up to date. It's the Daily Maverick Show, Tuesdays, 1 to 2 p.m. on CliffCentral.com.
Good afternoon. You're live with us on the Daily Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com. As usual, my name is Kingsley Kipuri, and I'll be your host for the next hour. We've got quite a packed show lined up for you. We'll be going continental. So we'll be talking a bit about South Sudan, Africa's youngest country, that has had a bit of a rocky start to independence since its separation from sort of the wider Sudan. So we'll be speaking to former Vice President Riek Machar, and hearing just his perspective on the violence going on there and his role or in perpetuating it, or rather his role in ending it. We just got a really, really great interview lined up. I can't wait to play you. And secondly, we'll be talking about an investigative journalist whose research has led him to find that the United States is secretly building, what should I call it, military bases across the continent, which is, I mean, astounding. So again, two really, really great exclusive interviews we'll be playing for you later. So please stay tuned. Remember, you can join the interview. Join the interview. You can join the conversation. Slow start, guys. I'm sorry. On Twitter, on @DMShowZA. Now, thankfully, I can stop talking and introduce my guest, the African Oracle, the Sub-Saharan Sage, Simon Allison. Welcome to the show, man.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be on, and it's nice to be talking about some really important issues, actually.
I mean, it's when you contacted me and you said this were going to be the topics, I just couldn't believe it. It's stuff that we haven't had a chance to really dig into in the past. So I'm happy to be able to jump in.
Absolutely. What are we doing first?
So let's start with South Sudan, a country that's not, I mean, it doesn't really always make headlines. I mean, it's generally the same kind of country that we end up discussing on here, and you find in the newspapers, your Ethiopias, Kenyas, Nigeria, and so on. So we don't talk about this too much. So I'd love to just start with some context. I mean, I just remember the fanfare in 2011 when South Sudan was sort of becoming a country. And then we just didn't hear much else after that.
You're right. There's a sort of Sudan fatigue. I think that the world sort of thinks that the problems there they've been going on for so long. Mm. They are so seemingly intractable that, well, we've just moved on to different, more interesting topics. But the reality is that South Sudan is in the middle of probably the deadliest civil war going on in Africa at the moment. This is the worst conflict that we are seeing on the continent. And really, it isn't getting much attention at all. There are only, I think, three or four foreign journalists in Juba looking at what's going on. So there's not a lot of news coming out. It is a tragic, tragic story. From the absolute euphoria of the Independence Day celebrations in 2011, where Africa created a new country, this generations-long struggle for freedom from the really brutal rule of Khartoum in the north. This victory was realized in a new country with a new flag and a new capital and a new currency, and everyone was so happy. I was in Juba about a year after that happened, and the mood was incredibly optimistic. There was this really palpable feeling that, yes, you know, we're poor and we haven't got the stuff we need, but we're building our future and we're going in the right direction. And after all this fighting, we are now ready to win the peace. And then December 2013, no one really knows what exactly happened, but some kind of firefight broke out in the presidential palace between soldiers loyal to Salva Kiir, the president, and forces loyal to Riek Machar, who was the deputy president. Both of these guys are lions of the liberation struggle in their own right. They are national heroes, icons, but they've never got along. Even when they were fighting together on the same side, they were in different factions, they were very mistrustful of each other. They come from different ethnic backgrounds, and they really haven't ever seen eye to eye. So once this fighting started in Juba, it really quickly escalated into something much bigger. And what happened is Riek Machar, the deputy president, he fled the capital and started building up a rebellion in the countryside. And that rebellion is what is still going on today. This fighting between the rebels and the government, they're fighting over cities, they're fighting over oil fields, they are fighting mostly for themselves, because you know what, the truth is that you know, the average citizen in South Sudan is not benefiting from this war at all. Quite the opposite. Millions of people are displaced. Hundreds of thousands are at risk of like severe food insecurity. No one knows what the death toll is, but we're probably talking definitely thousands, possibly tens of thousands. And along with that, we've seen some of the worst human rights abuses that we have ever seen on the African continent, like extraordinary stories of soldiers going into villages and lining daughters up against the wall and raping them, of locking villagers into their huts and burning the huts down. Really, really brutal, graphic stuff. And that is what's going on in South Sudan at the moment. So when I got a chance to interview Riek Machar, he's the rebel leader. He's the deputy president who really, you know, played a key role in causing all this. I was quite nervous because I knew that there were hard questions that I wanted to ask him, but I didn't know what kind of guy he was going to be. So it was, it was a really interesting interview. Probably one of the most difficult I've ever done. But also one of the most professionally rewarding, because he did talk. And even though I didn't buy his line on things, he was prepared to answer the difficult questions. He was prepared to engage in a debate. I think we really came out with an insight of what he thinks is going on. And it's very different from what the rest of us think is going on.
Okay. I don't think there's much else to be said before jumping in. So I'm just about to play you the interview that...
I just want to clarify, set the scene a little bit before we start. This interview was done in Addis Ababa, the capital of Ethiopia. And this might, you know, strike you as slightly surprising, but actually that's where Riek Machar has his residence. So he pretty much lives in Addis Ababa. So this rebel commander, you think he'd be on the front lines, or at least in the country he's fighting for.
Right.
No, he's in another country, in a beautiful part of town next to, you know, burger joints and fancy hotels. Debonairs has just opened around the corner.
Wonderful.
You know, so him and his men are living a life of luxury in Addis Ababa while waging the war at the same time. And that's where I went to see him, at his three-story house, a nice luxurious villa, beautiful furniture. And we met in the living room there.
All right, here we go.
This is CliffCentral.com.
Dr. Machar, what I'd like to ask you first is your vision of the future. If you were to imagine South Sudan in 5 years' time, where do you see your country?
It's like if wishes were horses. I would like South Sudan in 5 years a stable, outlooking, united, prosperous nation. We are underdeveloped now. We have big potential. We could come peace, and I'm optimistic that peace will come. Peace will prevail, actually. Want to go about doing their own business, creating life for themselves.
You say you're optimistic that peace will come.
Peace will prevail.
Many observers are not optimistic. What is the reasons for your optimism?
There's an agreement signed. We signed it. It's 5 months, 13 days since we signed it. If this agreement could be implemented with the necessary focus from the grantors of the peace agreement, peace would prevail in the country. Because there's no other choice. Only cause of following peace.
So the guarantors, you're saying they need to do more to guarantee the peace.
More.
Who specifically?
The IGAD, the Troika, they need to do more, because now they have left our president, violate the agreement, and I don't think they have given him the necessary pressure to ensure that he implements the agreement by letter and spirit.
Dr. Muchai, you've been involved in South Sudanese politics for decades now. You are already a hero of the liberation movement. You've been working hard for many, many years. Do you feel tired? Do you feel like you'd like to retire and spend time with your family?
You know, I've been, since the young days for the liberation, fighting for the welfare of South Sudan. Now South Sudan is independent. I'm very proud of it. I thank God for keeping me alive, see independence of South Sudan. I'm also a vehicle for change. I'm happy with the agreement signed, because this is going to usher in reforms. It will also usher in new system of governance, federalism in my country. And I'm satisfied with that. You know, when the time comes for me to retire, I will retire and say, I have done my part. I fought the battle.
And when do you think that time is?
Oh, time is coming close. It's coming close. Don't worry about that. It's coming. It's coming. It's inevitable. You know?
What will you do when you retire, just out of interest? Because it's hard to make a new life.
I have lived full life. What remains for me is to ensure things are moving correctly, and for others to take over. You know? So if there's anything I want to live longer for, it's to create stability in the country, and I see the system moves, even without me, you know. It's good to see a system once has created moving without that particular person, because this is when you are sure it will go longer.
Many outside observers have described the conflict in South Sudan as an ethnic conflict. Do you agree with this?
If it was an ethnic conflict, I would have quit long time ago. It's a battle of ideas. It's a battle of system of governance, political battle. It is not. Others want to make it, but that's their choice. But to me, create a system that will last in South Sudan is what I want. The tragedy the ethnic group I come from fell into. My first statement to them was, let's transform this tragedy into a national liberation movement that will bring about unity of the country, peace, development, prosperity, justice, democracy. So I didn't follow that line.
But it's an interesting point you raise. You are the leader of the opposition. Yes. But the opposition is many different groups, different militias, different commanders. Is it possible to lead all of those people, to keep them on the same page?
We have united them. In actual fact, our movement is very democratic. Since we established ourselves April 2014 into one unit, we have met as in conferences and in leadership level more than 7 times. This is not easy in liberation armed struggle. So we are a cohesive group now.
When you say things on, you know, it's not easy to meet, there are huge logistical challenges involved in this operation. And I know it's a sensitive topic, but I would like to ask you, where do the resources to fight this come from? Where does the money come from? Where did the arms come from? Because it's a very expensive business.
From our own people. People contribute. And international solidarity is still there also. People who want justice, democracy, development, contribute to such.
And what about the weapons?
The government buys them. We come and take them over from them.
Liberate them.
Yes.
The United Nations, there was recently a report that in the last few days that your name and President Salva Kiir's name are on a list of individuals that they would like to impose sanctions on. Mm. What is your reaction to this?
I say it's unfair. They're acting without justice. How can you acquit a perpetrator who is a victim? I am a victim. Why would sanctions be imposed on me? Why?
And will the sanctions, and they're also talking about an arms embargo, will that have a significant impact for you?
Arms embargo has no impact on me because I buy no arms. It's the government that buys arms.
What are your policies to alleviate the humanitarian crisis? There are more than 2 million people are displaced. Is there anything that you can do to help in the short term? And I know the long-term solution is for major political change in South Sudan, but in the short term, this crisis is affecting so many of your people.
Free movement of humanitarians, give them access to reach the needy, support the humanitarians in this effort without being interrupted, ensure that the ceasefire that we declared on the 29th is maintained so that there is no more displacement. The sooner the transitional government of national unity is formed, the better, so that we can cater for our people and support the international humanitarian action that is taking place. We have opened South Sudan to humanitarians to access any person who is in need.
Let me check, this is recording. Okay, that's good. Okay. Given that humanitarian suffering, it has been on a huge scale. There have been thousands of death, and I know you've said in the past that it is something that weighs heavily with you. Do you think maybe South Sudan's independence was a mistake?
I'm a hero of the independence. It can never be a mistake. We have found ourselves in this despicable situation, but that doesn't mean that our independence is not cherished. We cherish our independence. We fought for it for many generations. We have achieved it during our time. So the independence is is deserved by the people of South Sudan. They deserve it. And nothing will take it away from them.
To change the topic slightly, economically, the price of oil has fallen dramatically. How is this affecting both sides of this conflict? Because the government can't really afford to sell its oil with the royalties it must pay.
Well, I think this should force the government to accept to honor the peace deal, so that the little we can get from the oil or from any other resources that we have is used for giving services to the people, rather than use those resources to fight war. So when the oil was booming, the government was buying arms from all over the world. Now it's going to be constrained by the fact that this resource is not anymore getting revenue to it. And I think that will give it a better realization than anything else.
The other question I wanted to ask you was, there was the African Union report, which documented very severe human rights violations committed by both sides in this conflict. I know you can't account for the government, but you know the troops that answer to you, they are committing very serious crimes. How do you deal with that as a commander-in-chief?
You know, I said we formally organized April 2014. The violations that are being enumerated happened prior to this date. But however, we took responsibility that since the groups that we have brought together to form the outfit I now lead, we take responsibility. But we have contained these violations now. We were very open to investigation. We are satisfied with the investigation done by the international community, whether it is done by ICRC or by the UN. And once the situation is calm, we'll take action on those individuals that committed such atrocities. Some are known, some we may not know, but we'll stem it out.
And many African leaders recently have been very critical of the ICC and its role in Africa. Do you think that it has a role in South Sudan, that it could be a force for positive change?
I'm not a critic of ICC. Because after all, what is ICC wanting to do? Is to ensure that impunity is stamped out. Crimes against humanity, war crimes, genocide, aggression are avoided. These are the four principles on which the ICC is established. If any country does not want the ICC to be involved in their own, then they must ensure that they avoid committing such atrocities. And they must ensure that the Rome Statute is internalized in their own law. And the ICC and their courts work efficiently. And the ICC will not come in.
Would you, if the ICC were to issue an arrest warrant for one of your generals, would you hand that
person
over?
We would. We were committed to combating impunity. So. it's a recognition of the fact that our country is not in a position to try those who have committed atrocities, particularly in the four areas, crimes against humanity, war crimes, genocide, aggression. Since we have no law against this, and there is a body that can access, do this work, well, in the peace agreement we fought hard that there would be a hybrid court that will handle these issues. So this court will definitely handle these issues. And it is a continental court. Mm-hmm. There will be South Sudanese, there will be others from Africa. So we can't contradict ourselves since we already have committed to it.
Yes. Dr. Machar, much has been made of your relationship with President Kiir. I wanted to ask you, what is your relationship with President Kiir, and what do you think of him as a person and a leader?
We worked together for 8 years. At difficult times. Until he removed me, until he triggered the violence of December 15th, 2013. If in government, if we had worked for 8 years together, what is 3 years? And before that, prior in the liberation, we were working together.
Do you like him?
I don't have to like him.
Isn't it, I mean, again, given the sort of the levels of humanitarian suffering, do you sometimes think maybe it's best to just give up? To stop the fighting so that the suffering stops?
The fighting has stopped. An agreement is on. Giving up would be being irresponsible. You give up, like your first question, you leave when things are settled. When you see that this is the cause of things will not go worse, then you left them. You don't leave when there are crises. That would be irresponsibility. History will not forgive one for that.
So just to clarify, so from your perspective, the long-term damage of not fighting this is worse than, you know, you're prepared to take some, you know, prepared to do this fighting now because you believe there is a long-term future that is better.
Definitely. I spent all my life for liberation of South Sudan. I would have done something better for my own self. But I forsake that. You know? So, resisting dictatorships is worthwhile than accepting them, thinking that things will change themselves alone. They don't. Human beings, they change course of life.
Swachai, you were in Uganda earlier this week.
Yes.
Uganda has played a very significant role. With their troops that have been in South Sudan. What did you and President Museveni talk about?
Well, we talked about this. They interfered, they fought us, they fought along the current regime. They had played three roles. The role of supporting a government which to us, a government that has killed its people. They also played a role of trying to get a peaceful solution in the search for peace and stability. They did that. And now they are grantors of the peace agreement. So I went to visit him on the last agenda that he's a grantor of this agreement. And I want to turn a new page in the relations so that we implement the peace agreement.
My last question, Dr. Machana, thank you for taking the time to speak to us. How would you like history to remember your role?
Creating the country.
That's not a bad thing, Dr. That's pretty cool.
Created the country.
And do you have
I was fought by my brothers when I said self-determination is what we should fight for, and by my enemies. And in the end, we won. Self-determination. We are free.
And do you have any regrets?
If I would have, my regrets would be the death, the suffering that my people have got, and those who got involved in all these struggles. These are my regrets. But then I tell my people, there's no independence on a silver plate. We have to sacrifice for it.
Thank you very much.
This is CliffCentral.com.
If you're just tuning in, we just aired our exclusive. Can we say exclusive if it's already been on Twitter and on the article?
We're gonna run with
Let's
it anyway.
Let's just say exclusive. You heard it here first. All the fun things to say. Interview with former Vice President of South Sudan and now rebel leader, Dr. Riek Machar, by Simon Allison, who I have in studio with me. I mean, Simon, like I said to you, before, hearing that, he sounds like a really reasonable guy, actually a nice guy, and really paints himself as a victim and somebody just trying to do the right thing. But, you weren't too convinced.
He was lovely. I was charmed. I had a great time. He was hospitable. He was courteous. He commands an easy sort of respect. I felt like I was having a nice chat with my grandfather. It was that kind of relationship, that kind of vibe that he gives off. And a lot of the stuff he says superficially makes sense. Mm. There is a sort of internal consistency in the messages that he's pushing. Mm. This idea that it's, the government's fault that he wants peace, but the other side won't move, that he's laid down his weapons, that the other side keeps fighting, but it's just not true. At one point, when he was talking about human rights violations, he said, we haven't committed any human rights violations since 2014. Rubbish. Absolute nonsense. This idea that, since the peace agreement was signed, that his fighters have laid down their weapons. Also, absolute nonsense. There have been several reports of rebel forces going in and massacring villages and killing people. So, you sort of wonder. There are two options. Number one, he is actually deluded. So, he's sitting in Addis Ababa. His generals on the ground are feeding him information. Mm. What information are they feeding him? How accurate is that information? We don't know. He's built up this picture of himself as a liberation fighter. Yeah. He thinks he's waging a just war, and he's managed to convince himself that he is doing so. He's found ways to explain away all the inconsistencies. That's not out of the realms of possibility. These kinds of leaders, they have a sort of megalomania, almost a disorder that allows them to do this. On the other hand, maybe he's also just a very experienced politician who knows how to charm people, who knows how to tell people what they want to hear, who knows how to sell his side of the story. Either way, he is presiding over extraordinary amounts of suffering. And so to hear him say at one point in that interview, "I am a victim," even during the interview itself, it made me want to sort of get up and leave the room. Because how can a man who, even if he does believe in what he's doing, he's still living in comfort in Addis Ababa, ordering people to go die, ordering people to go and kill. He is not the victim in any way, shape, or form. It's the South Sudanese people who are suffering through this that are the victims. And he doesn't seem to get that.
Are you convinced that he does have the power to end this if he made the command and he...
Perhaps not. He is sort of divorced from the fighting on the ground. He's not in full control of his generals that are on his side. Which again is, you know, he said he was in the interview. He said everyone's on the same page. Well, no, they're not. And so, you know, if he were to say, you know what, this war's silly, let's stop fighting, would his generals listen? Perhaps not. But also, you still got to try. He still is in a position to at least moderate the worst consequences of this war, and he is not doing so.
Okay, my final question on this post-interview, how has this changed, if at all, your sort of analysis and looking at the South Sudanese situation on the conflict? Has it changed it at all? Is it looking good? Any end in sight?
I think, to be honest, it has made me more pessimistic, because getting so close to one of the key movers in the conflict and seeing just how stubborn he is, just how unwilling to make real concessions, just how unwilling he is to actually live in the real world of facts and information. You know, he is living for one, you know, I don't know which explanation it is, but he is living in this bubble. Maybe cynically, or maybe he is deluded, we don't know, but that is the war he's fighting. He's not fighting the real war on the ground, it seems, and he's not negotiating around that. And he's also not... He has made the strategic calculation that whatever long-term goal he has in his mind, you know, this more freedom, more independence, you know, he was very vague on what he actually wants from this war. It's all just platitudes. But that long-term goal is worth... He has decided it is worth any amount of suffering. And he even said that in the interview, you know, the people have to make sacrifices. And that, to me, is a sign of someone who... is very readily the human cost of this war is not weighing as heavily on him as it should. It's not influencing his decision making. I imagine the same is true of his counterpart on the government side, President Salva Kiir, who has been, if anything, more obstinate, more difficult to deal with than Machar. So I don't see any swift resolution in sight while these two dinosaurs are essentially slugging it out between themselves, regardless of the consequences.
There you go. Not too much I can add there. We're just going to go into a quick commercial break and then we'll be right back.
We have all given the special lady in our lives a gift that she might not have loved as much as we expected she would. Don't leave it to chance this Valentine's Day. Spoil her with a genuine piece of Pandora jewelry, a unique gift that she will cherish forever from only 399 Rand. Visit Pandora.net to locate your nearest store or follow them on Facebook at Pandora South Africa and take the guesswork out of gifting.
Stay informed and up to date. It's the Daily Maverick Show, Tuesdays 1 to 2 p.m. on CliffCentral.com.
Good afternoon. You're back with us on the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. Just going into the last quarter of the show, and Simon will be telling us his thoughts on the new Beyoncé video and the halftime show. He's been analyzing that intensely, and I will save you trying to even answer that question. But anyway, Twitter tells me it was amazing. I haven't seen it. I hear it's great. I don't know, you know, whatever. Anyway, a lot going on in the country. We have a Kandler case hearing at the Constitutional Court. We've got two journalists there, Anjani Munasami and Greg Nicholson, who are tweeting live from there. So please, if you're on Twitter, head over there and see what's going on, and we'll make sure to cover that at the next show. But for the last portion, we want to, you know, shift gears a bit and talk about sort of American military influence on the continent. Now, Simon, when you told me you were working on this, my sort of first very naive thought was, why does America have military bases on the continent at all? Before we get to
it's not naive. It's a great question. You know, like, what on earth is the American military doing on another continent?
And now to talk, I mean, one, I don't understand that. And two, now it's not that... Why do they have them? They have now secret ones on top of the not secret ones that everybody is okay with. So, I mean.
So, I guess here's what we know about America and Africa. This is what's official on record.
Okay.
Is they have. The American military has divided the world into sort of different spheres. Mm-hmm. And they have a special, you know, a sort of contingent of the army which is dedicated to African issues. Mm-hmm. It's called AFRICOM. The Africa Command. It's based in Stuttgart in Germany, because no African country is really willing to host such a major American military base, in public at least. On the continent itself, what they have is one major base in Djibouti called Camp Limonier. The French also have a little a contingent there. And that base has, I mean, a lot of troops, like more than 10,000 troops, I think. Jeez. And they have a runway. They bring transport planes in there. They do have fighter jets there. They have drones there. And this is, you know, this we know about their footprint in Africa. Now, Nick Terse is an investigative journalist with a site called TomDispatch.com. It is a really, really fantastic site. It's American, but it looks very closely at America's foreign policy, and it sort of tells the stories that mainstream media miss or, you know, aren't that interested in. A lot of what they do is trying to pick holes, I think, in what the U.S. military or the State Department says it's doing versus what it's actually doing. And Nick Terse made his name. I mean, he's produced lots of great work, but one of his biggest was he looked into accounts of U.S. massacres in Vietnam, in the Vietnam War, and he uncovered a lot of those. They were a lot more widespread than we realized. They were a lot more deliberate than we realized. I mean, it was his work that brought that to the fore. Now, while he was doing some research into the U.S. military, he sort of kept coming across random documents. You know, there'd be some kind of tender notice, and it would, you know, be tendering about this, and then also there's something for something in Africa. And he kept seeing little clues that indicated something was going on in Africa, but when he approached AFRICOM to ask,
what's going on?
They said, no, there's nothing. We have one military base in Djibouti, and that is all. So he said, no, this doesn't add up. And he devoted a lot of his time, took him a couple of years, to investigate what's going on. And now you can't just Google this stuff. This is really intense investigative journalism. You also can't just ask the U.S. military because they're not going to answer you. So what he had to do was he had to, like, you know, he had to work the system. He almost had to game the system. And so what he would look at, you know, U.S. military departmental budgets and break those down and see if there was any lines that were attached to something else. He would look at requisition orders for, you know, these clamshell hangars, they're called, which is what they erect at these secret military bases to put the planes in. You know, if how many hangars have been ordered and where do they go? And then try and piece it together from there. He would use, and this is quite astonishing, he'd use Google Earth.
I was just thinking, can you just look?
You can literally look. So he'd like scour like patches of desert in the Sahel. Jeez. And I think he had a few tip-offs of where he should be looking.
Jeez.
But those satellites capture stuff. There's one in Djibouti, and on the Daily Maverick article we wrote about this, which I think we'll tweet out the link.
Yeah, we'll share that just now.
We've got a picture of the secret base in Djibouti where the U.S. military have been denying that they're building anything. But there, quite clearly, you can see the runway.
You just want to hold up the picture and be like, what's this?
What's this?
Like, we don't know.
You know, you can see the runway. You can see the sort of U.S. standard issue equipment that is being used to build.
Yeah.
And eventually, over the course of his research, he uncovered something like 60 secret bases.
So we went from 1 to 60.
In the interview, we've asked him to describe what they look like, and we've also asked him to explain to us why. You know, as you said at the beginning, what on earth is the U.S. military doing all over Africa?
All right. That's a big question. We'll play the interview right now, also exclusive, and you heard it here first, and all those wonderful things. And we'll be back. It's just under 10 minutes. We'll play it right now.
This is CliffCentral.com.
So, Nick, the U.S. officially has one base in Africa. Your research suggests something a little bit different, doesn't it?
That's right. When I studied this, late in 2015, the count that I came up with was 60 different outposts, compounds, facilities, austere locations located all over the continent, north to south, east to west. U.S. military is loath to call these bases, but it's difficult to see them as anything but. Many of them are aircraft capable, C-130s, which are major transport aircraft, can land at them. Many of these are also drone bases.
Can you describe, you know, what might one of these bases look like?
Generally, one of these bases is an airstrip with a number of what they call clamshell enclosures, which are these sort of beige, sand-colored. They look like tents from the air, but they have a hard frame. These are used to store aircraft. They're used for aircraft maintenance. Then there are some. They'll generally have hard structure tents that are put up. You'll often find satellite equipment at these bases as well. You know, this is how they start. And then some, like Camp Lomagne in Djibouti, which is the major U.S. military base on the continent. Then they'll have more permanent structures that you know, that are designed for the long term.
This suggests that the U.S. military is planning on expanding its operations in Africa quite dramatically. What is the U.S. military's interest in Africa?
Well, I think that you know, since 9/11, since 2001, the U.S. military has looked at Africa as a source of instability, a place that's either likely to produce terror groups or be the location that that terrorist groups would relocate to. So as a result, you know, the U.S. is you know, really the U.S. has you know, increased its footprint every way possible. You know, what it's tried to do in many ways is work with local militaries, African forces across the continent to build up these forces to act as proxy forces in the fight against various terror outfits. When the U.S. Africa Command, the umbrella organization for all U.S. military activity on the continent, was created in 2008. It was running about 172 of these military-to-military missions each year. In 2014, that had jumped to 674 per year, so a 300% increase over that time. And you know, this has been you can see this with the missions, bases, all of this, and it's all been geared towards you know, anti-terrorism activities, often with you know, the exact opposite results of what the U.S. has pursued.
How forthcoming has AFRICOM been with you about its intentions and about the scale of the operations in Africa?
Not very. It's very difficult to get any kind of information out of AFRICOM. You know, very tight-lipped. They often won't even give me you know, basic information about what they're doing. So, you know, as a result, I've had to get creative in my methods, piece together information from a variety of sources, open source material, internal Pentagon documents, documents that I obtained through what we call Freedom of Information Act requests, which is classified material. Sometimes you can get your hands on it. And try and put all this together with, you know, hopefully you can find, you know, some former AFRICOM personnel who will talk, and together, you know, with enough time and work, you can start to get an idea of what they're doing.
This must be costing an extraordinary amount of money. Where is it all coming from?
AFRICOM's budget?
The expansion of bases in Africa. Who's financing it?
I mean, this is, you know, U.S. taxpayer dollars at work. You know, these bases are, a lot of times they're hidden in the budget, but, you know, this is it's a sizable outlay of money. Just to give you an example, you know, the U.S. is putting in a base right now in Agadez in Niger, and, you know, this base is a $50 million investment. So this is courtesy of the American people. They're putting in airstrip. It's certainly going to be a drone base, and probably, you know, looking towards the fight with Boko Haram. So this is a serious outlay of America's money. You know, what could you know, possibly be used for, you know, humanitarian aims or development in Africa is instead going towards this military infrastructure.
And then my last question, Nick. How does the U.S. military's footprint in Africa, which you have very helpfully shown is much larger than we thought it was, how does this compare with its footprint in other regions of the world?
Well, I think, you know, what's going on in Africa is very different than what you see in other areas of the world. You know, a few years ago, the U.S. Government was talking about a pivot to Asia to counterbalance China. They would increase their footprint all over that region. That really never seemed to amount to anything. A few Marines sent to Darwin, Australia, maybe building up some more bilateral ties in the region. But what I've seen and documented is a true, you know, pivot to Africa, where there's tangible base building all over the continent. You know, it's akin to what we saw in some ways in Iraq and Afghanistan. Not at that level, but a lot of building going on almost all the time now. Very different than what you see in Asia. Certainly different than what's going on in you know, other theaters where the U.S. has a presence, such as Europe or even South America and the Caribbean.
Perfect. Nick, thank you very much for talking to the Daily Maverick.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is CliffCentral.com.
That was our interview by Simon Allison with Nick Tiss, investigative journalist who's uncovered more than 60 secret U.S. military bases across the continent. We've just got probably a minute or two to go. I just want to jump into the AU sitting that happened last week, 2 weeks ago. And Simon Allison is with me in studio, was there. And Simon, the big question leading into that was about Burundi. We've had a lot of instability over there. Mm. And we're waiting for the AU, the leaders, our leaders, to sit down and tell us what they're going to do about it. What happened?
Not a lot. Oh, well, not things we wanted to see happen. So the big thing coming into the summit was that the African Union's Peace and Security Council had approved a peacekeeping force and said, you know, we want to send a peacekeeping force to Burundi to stabilize the situation, stop the violence. Burundi said it doesn't want the force, which complicates things. But the idea was that at this summit, they'd take that Peace and Security Council decision and they'd get the General Assembly to rubber stamp it. And what that would do, even if Burundi doesn't accept the peacekeeping force, is it puts the pressure on Nkurunziza. It acts as further leverage to get him to the negotiating table. You know, it just means, you know, it keeps the heat on the situation. Get to Addis, have another meeting of the Peace and Security Council, this time with heads of state, although not Pierre Nkurunziza, because he's too scared to leave Bujumbura after the last coup attempt. But what the leaders, you know, what they came out with after that was that they basically scrapped the idea of the peacekeeping force. It is still provisionally on the table, like in theory, but in reality, the African Union is not pursuing this anymore. That's what the ambassadors said to us in the corridors afterwards. Some of the ambassadors who were in the meeting came out and said stuff like, you know what, the situation in Burundi's not so bad, really. It's been exaggerated. You know, the human rights organizations are, you know, they're seeing things that aren't there. And this, to me, was the most damaging bit of all, because they essentially just swallowed the Burundian government's propaganda. And that's what they were making their decision on, even though the AU's own internal reports, this was the info they'd based the December decision on. They say, yes, things are as bad as it seems. The UN's reports say, yes, things are as bad as it looks. But the AU in this meeting backtracked, took all the pressure off Burundi, and Pierre Nkurunziza's foreign minister was sort of jumping around the room, beaming, and saying that this was a vindication for Pierre Nkurunziza and a victory for Burundi. So I think, all in all, it was a pretty big fail as far as the African Union is concerned.
There you hear it. Pretty much no action from the AU on the Burundi crisis, I think we could definitely call it. It's exact, just about 2 p.m., the longest show we've ever had. I'm in a lot of trouble, so I'll just say goodbye now. Please download the podcast, share it far and wide. Tweet us. We love you all, good people of our listeners. We'll see you next week.
Stay informed and up to date. It's the Daily Maverick Show, Tuesdays, 1 to 2 p.m. on CliffCentral.com. CliffCentral.com.